This is Mark Steiner. Welcome back, folks. Good to have you with us here on The Mark Steiner Show. And on our way to our national roundtable, we want to take a short detour. And there's two people I want to remember today that passed away. One of them is a figure that was really one of the bravest men, among the bravest men during the Vietnam War. Many of you have or have not heard about the My Lai massacre that took place in the Vietnam War, where over 500 Vietnamese were slaughtered by American troops, mostly men, women, and children. And there were three men in a helicopter that stopped that from continuing. The last one passed away, and I'm being joined here by a dear friend of mine, who Wayne Carlin, one of our great authors who wrote Wandering Souls and many, 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 many other books, who co-produced our Vietnam series with us. He is a Vietnam veteran who was a Marine Corps helicopter gunner. That doesn't even begin to describe who Wayne Carlin really is, but Wayne joins us by phone here for a few minutes. Wayne, good to have you with us.
Good morning, Mark.
So last night we lost this man, Lawrence Colburn, who along with Hugh Thompson and Andriotta, is it Neil Andriotta, right?
Glenn Andriotta.
Glenn Andriotta.
Yeah.
Take us back to that moment in 1968 in Vietnam and what happened and why it's so important to remember these three men, and this man being the last of the three who passed away just yesterday.
Well, the three were on a helicopter crew. You would see pilot Glenn Andriotta, the crew chief, and Larry was the gunner. On that day of the My Lai massacre, they were flying, you know, observation, and what they saw on the ground was that, you know, first a lot of corpses. They couldn't understand, since they had seen no fire, no artillery fire, no gunfire on the ground, where the corpses were coming from. Eventually, you know, to make it short, I mean, Hugh Thompson, the pilot, kept coming in and trying to find out what was going on. He was putting green smoke near the clusters of wounded people. You know, usually you did that with a flare to indicate that these people needed help. And what they started noticing is when they came back, that the people who had been wounded were killed. And you know, eventually they figured out that there was a slaughter going on the ground. Thompson became enraged and upset, and at one point they landed the helicopter between a group of approaching Americans and a group of Vietnamese who were trying to hide in a bunker. And Colburn and Andriotta loosened their machine guns. They're attached by bungee cords, and came out of the helicopter. And Thompson told the approaching troops that they would open fire on them if they advanced on the Vietnamese. And then they called down two of the other gunships that were flying overhead. They came down and evacuated those people. Later on, a little later on, they were flying over a ditch and seeing, you know, it was over 100 Vietnamese who were in the ditch. It was the second time they were flying over. The first time people had been wounded, and they came back. They saw people firing into the ditch, and most of them were dead. Andriotta noticed that there seemed to be some movement down there, so they landed next to the ditch, and he and Larry got out, and Andriotta waded in, basically, you know, literally waded into the dead and pulled out turned out to be a little boy who was alive. They flew to a hospital. And then, you know, when they reported this, I mean, it was covered up. It's a kind of long story what they went through to at first try to report it, and then being shut up. The Army attempted about a year later to give them medals, which you know, they took but refused, because the medals were, you know, for a mythical situation the Army, you know, made up at that point. And eventually, you know, the Army investigated. The truth about the massacre came out. As you said, there were over 500 people killed. It was a, you know, cold-blooded killings. This was not in the heat of combat.
And I think before we conclude here, and it's something we can come back to another day, but it just the fact that these three men stood between the Vietnamese villagers and their own troops, their fellow Americans. This is a hugely brave and powerful act that these men did. And I think that's something we just can't forget. And the fact that Lawrence Colburn passed away, the last of those men, is something for us to remember.
Yeah, and you got to know also, I mean, he suffered for over 40 years with PTSD and drug problems and everything else. And it was through, you know, working with you, Thompson, that really brought him back, trying to educate people, talking a lot to the military. And, you know, the two of them felt that they had saved other people in the situations in the present war because they had spoken to, you know, to the troops who were going to war about, you know, the fact of moral courage. You know, you need physical courage in battle, you need to survive, but you know, moral courage is what keeps you keeps you human, and they demonstrated it that day against all the pressures you can imagine. You know, the peer pressure, the pressure from command, the pressure just to do nothing, you know, to go along with it, and which is intensified in the combat zone. So, yeah, they're an example that, you know, at times when you need, these times we need a lot of civic and moral courage.
Yes, we do. And that's the only reason I wanted to have you help us remember that. Wayne Carlin, who was a sergeant in the U.S. Marines during the Vietnam War, has done more to bridge the gap between Vietnamese culture and American culture in terms of writers gathering who are all veterans of that war. Incredible amount of work. Also a colleague and a dear friend. Wayne, thank you for all you've done, both not just your service, but also for the voice of reason and peace you've become. So I appreciate you, and thanks so much for taking some time with us today.
Thank you, Mark. Take care.
Take care. So we just wanted to start the show off today to remember that moment, because I think it's apropos for this time. We need men and women of great moral courage at this moment. We are here today with Quincy Gamble of One Baltimore, a Democratic operative and worked for labor unions in the Democratic Party and doing many different things. Dr. Ann McCarthy is with us. She's dean of the business school at Hamline University in Minneapolis and used to be here in Maryland. We met when she ran for comptroller as a Republican. Kevin Gastola, did I say that right? Gastola?
Yeah, that's correct.
Good. To make sure I had it right, man. Kevin Gastola, who's a journalist and managing editor of ShadowProof.com. Welcome. Good to have the three of you with us.
Good to be here, brother.
And you all can join us out there at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can get on our Facebook pages. Some people have already gotten on there for the next hour show. We're looking forward to talking about that. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner, but 410-319-8888. So today is the Electoral College. The electors in this very strange system we have in America, where we don't actually vote for president, we vote for electors,
yeah,
who then can verify who the president will be. Many people are trying to push them not to vote for Donald Trump, though the chances of that happening are slim to none. But it's an interesting process. Kevin, why don't you start us off with what this process means?
Well, in my view, I think that there's been a lot of importance put into the Electoral College vote that isn't all that necessary, but I understand that the whole system is set up this way because historically, you know, we've had the popular vote, and then you've got the Electoral College vote that goes in, and, you know, this process, I think, what we're seeing unfold, it opens up a lot of opportunity to ask critical questions about the kind of system we want to have in this country. With all the people who are protesting, with everybody that is upset with how things have happened, with how Donald Trump has risen to power, it's definitely an opportunity to assess, you know, where did the Electoral College come from? I've seen a number of pieces published in the last month or two pointing to how this developed as a way to compromise between slave states and non-slave states back when our country was developing. And so I think that it's crucial for people to be thinking about what they want this country to be, because the outcome of this vote is going to be probably what we predicted, that Donald Trump will still be president of the United States. But the interest in having a different result and then also having something different and no longer having an Electoral College, I think that's a worthy conversation.
Quincy?
I agree.
I mean, in your years as a Democratic operative, I'm curious, had you ever railed against the Electoral College before this?
No, I just think you do the work to win the race. And so the work is skewed to win the electoral battle. That's why you see the 10 to 12 battleground states every year. And only when you lose do you put sort of an outsized emphasis on the actual process. I think, like the previous guest said, it's a worthy conversation to have. But to be honest, I'm still stuck in, you know, why we lost. We knew what the goal was. We had to win 270 electoral votes, and we didn't get it done. That does not take away from the frustration about actually the moment that we're living through. So,
Ann?
Well, I would like to say Alexander Hamilton is having a stellar year.
Right.
Between a play about him on Broadway that is, you know, busting all records, and the Electoral College being front and center, which, by the way, he wrote up Federalist Papers. He, you know, he's getting a lot of attention, and they didn't take him off the $20 bill after all.
Not yet.
It is a part of our, I think we need to remember that we don't really have a democracy, we have a representative democracy, and that's what the Founding Fathers or Brothers planned from the beginning. And that just as we have a Supreme Court and legislative and executive branch for balance of powers, or we also have a Supreme Court to protect the minority against the majority, and that was Alexander Hamilton's point in the Federalist Paper. The Founding Fathers were afraid of the tyranny of the majority, and so they set up all of these little things in the Constitution. I shouldn't say the little things. They set up all of these balances and checks in the Constitution to keep away from the tyranny of the majority. But sometimes the majority, you know, is right. And in this case, people are unhappy with Electoral College because it's not in line with the popular vote.
You know, I was thinking about that. Let me stop that for a moment. I'd like to hear what our listeners think at 410-319-8888. I mean, I've done a lot of reading over the years about the Electoral College, about the Federalist Papers and the founding of this country. I've read a lot and thought a lot about it and have many discussions around this. And one of the things that it was clear to me that the Electoral College really was put in place to ensure that 3/5 of a man mm-hmm. vote, counting the slaves in the South, ensure that places like Virginia would be more important than Pennsylvania, which was more populous as a whole.
People, yes.
Right? And you can read these Wilson-Madison debates that took place when this was being debated. And it was very clear what James Madison was saying in his debate with Wilson, who was saying, no, we don't need an electoral college. There needs to be a popular vote. And it was a huge debate. And that was the reason that this exists. Mm-hmm. So we have the legacy of that giving us what we have today. You also, you know, when you mentioned Ann McCarthy, tyranny of the majority over the minority, that sound, you know, for years that always sounded like a beautiful phrase and sentiment to me, because minorities are historically screwed, for want of a better term, as a professional term, mm-hmm. by people in many societies, and it was to protect minorities. But that's not what that meant. What they were talking about was the minority of people with lots of money and power. Wealthy white men did not want to be ruled by the majority of working class white men and middle class white men to say what they could say to run the country. So it wasn't like protecting black folks or native people or Jews or Italians or anybody else. It was about protecting the wealthy against the masses, which is what this was for. So, I mean, you know, it's this time that I think we really need to, and given this election in many ways was about people's anger at that minority.
Yeah.
It should give us some pause to think about what we are talking about the future of this democracy. What does it really mean?
So back then, the masses, the wealthy didn't have to be protected from the masses because only the wealthy voted. You had to be a white male landowner to vote. So I'm not, you know, the idea was that one populist group could not overrun the rights of the others. Now, whether or not, I mean, that has a lot of back history for us. I agree to that. Now, your question, though, is what are we doing? I don't see the people who voted for Donald Trump as the wealthy, you know, the wealthy landowners of the country. Is that what you're saying, Mark?
I'm saying that, and Kevin, you can jump in here, too, and both of you guys jump in as well. What I'm saying is that notion of tyranny of the majority against minority, had a lot of philosophical roots, but one of the main roots of that was to ensure that those who were the wealthiest in the country, that made these decisions, that wrote the documents, that created the government, were not overthrown by the majority of other white male property owners who were not necessarily part of their elite.
So it legislated the outsizing advantage of the privileged. But in this cycle, it seems like that sort of flipped.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
Yes. Right. That's what I'm saying. Kevin, you want to leap in on this a little bit?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, what we saw happen in the last year was savviness on the part of the Republican Party to recognize that Donald Trump had a message that could appeal to working class voters and writing it. And I think that when you do look at the makeup of people who support and are going to push Donald Trump's policies, you will find a lot of those, what you could say a long time ago in our country's history, would have been the wealthy landowners, you know, would have been the people who are the investors, the brokers, the people who have the money. But the fact is that they adopted a language which has been done by politicians, whether they are Democrat or Republican. Historically, there have been people who have come from, a lot of them from southern parts of the United States, and they adopt jargon and they speak to the quote-unquote common man, they appeal to whether it be their nativism or their fears, or they appeal to what they think this country could be and how it could be better. And they recognize that there's things going on in the country that make them unhappy and uncomfortable. And I believe that we just have to face up to the fact that Hillary Clinton didn't have that kind of message, never was willing to adopt it. In fact, there were people within her campaign who were managing it that were reluctant to adopt certain messages that would appeal to these people that could have made states that matter, like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, a whole lot closer. And so that's why we find ourselves in this situation talking about the Electoral College and whether it's possible that something dramatic could happen today.
And most likely not dramatic. But you're shaking your head, because you're somebody who's run campaigns, and you were head of Hillary's campaign here, not that she was going to lose Maryland.
Right. Well, I just agree with his point. I just think—
You disagree?
I agree.
Oh, agree.
I agree that, you know, I've just chosen to be introspective in this moment about what we could have done better. And so I definitely abhor what President-elect Trump campaigned on and how he won the election. But I do believe that we left the openings there and we didn't seize on areas where we could have been strong and should have been stronger.
So I would agree with Quincy and Kevin, but I would also say there was no Republican Party riding the wave of Donald Trump. I mean, they seem to be fighting him tooth and nail, except perhaps for some of these people who stayed quiet. So we didn't know whether they were Trump supporters or not. And now suddenly they're appearing to be more, you know, vocal. But there was no, even Donald Trump didn't think he was going to win. There was no way.
I absolutely believe that's true.
Right. No, it's absolutely true. I have enough Republican friends who were in the building that night at the RNC to know that it was the shock of all shocks that that it happened. But, you know, everyone's smarter Monday morning quarterback.
Right.
I told you so.
But let me ask you this question, Anna. Let me take this in a different direction for a moment. And I do want our listeners to join us here at 410-319-8888, or you can email us at talk@steinershow.org, tweet us at Mark Steiner. I want to hear your thoughts on this next question. And I'm asking you this question because of you both being a Republican and being a Republican who sees herself as a moderate Republican who loves what the Republican Party stood for. Do you believe there is a way to heal the breach that has deepened in America?
Hmm. Wow. Not without a lot of listening and a lot of compassion, and I don't see either side doing that. Seriously, I know people who are Democrats who are my good friends that don't want to be in a room with anybody who voted for Donald Trump, if anybody would even admit that. And I know people who voted for Donald Trump who just don't want to hear anything from the left. And I don't know how we got so polarized. It's horrible.
But this isn't this a moment where you know Donald Trump is the president-elect?
I'm not saying that.
Well.
he is.
In a couple hours, he will be. And
even though it's not really officially announced until January the 6th.
Absolutely. But if there is going to be some healing of the divide, first of all, there's going to take some leadership from the elected, from the president-elect. This victory tour was so insulting, and I thought it was horrendous. It was basically a sort of a rehashing of the greatest hits from the campaign with a little bit of softening on the lock her up chant, but there was no forward lean from the president-elect to bring this country together. And no matter who you voted for, we are where we are now. And if we are going to begin to heal as a country, I think it starts with him.
I agree. But
well, before we go to the phones here, Kevin, one of the things that, you know, I've, on this program, I have talked a lot about the huge divide we have in this country, much of it around race and racism that divides us in America, I think. But beyond that, I have people I am close to, friends, mm-hmm. And probably some family members as well, that have voted for Donald Trump, And they are beautiful, decent human beings. And I think that, can we start from that point and see what that commonality is? Maybe some of the anger that rose out of Bernie's campaign, the anger that rose out of Black Lives Matter, the anger that rose out of Trump's campaign, people feeling completely dispossessed through Appalachia and much of the white working class in the Midwest. Maybe there is reason for hope in terms of something that can be built because rather than sit around and spend the rest of these next 4 years demonizing one another. And I'm taking a different tack than I have, but I think it's important to consider that.
Very
Kevin?
Different.
Yeah, no, I think that's an important thing to bring into the discussion. And I believe that what we've seen, not only in this election, but in the past two elections, but also I think it was much more pronounced, is that there are citizens in this country that aren't sure that they can express themselves through going to vote in the presidential election. They just, you know, they find themselves exceptionally frustrated with the candidates that end up being the nominees. And I'm sorry if this might be a little bit taboo in a conversation with a Democrat and a Republican.
No such
here,
thing. Go ahead. Not here.
Not here.
But people feeling like the nominees that are being put before them are some of the worst choices that they could be asked to choose between in an election year that is of great importance. And so I'm not sure what the answer is, but I think there needs to be some discussion about whether you're going to democratize the process much more further, whether you're going to put some kind of systems in place that would allow for the rise of more fusion-type parties? Are we going to embrace more fusion-style politics? Are we going to let, you know, local and state have their own parties and maybe that influences more larger national parties? You know, what kind of system are we going to have that starts to allow people who have a range of views to be able to express themselves when they are voting so that we don't just have polarization? Because I do think that there's something to, and it's probably for another discussion, but there's something to it being Democrat versus Republican every 4 years that really adds to the partisan divide.
Yeah, take us a break, Quincy. We've got to take a break and we're going to come right back.
I've been doing a lot of reading and a lot of talking over the last month or so, and it seems like the campaign that we needed for this cycle, and it's going to sound crazy because some folks argue me down, is Jesse Jackson's campaign of a true rainbow coalition where the commonality between those who are suffering in urban America and those who are suffering in Appalachia really came together in a movement that just did not have the steam to scale.
When he ran in the Democratic primary.
When he ran the Democratic primary. So there is a message there. And that message is within the Democratic Party. So that's the exception that I would take to Kevin's assertion.
We're going to take a short break here. And Owusu in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, you're the first caller up. Then we go to Jeffrey here in Baltimore. So we hear from both of you when we come back at 410-319-8888. We'll continue this conversation with our three guests. Do not go away. Whoa. Welcome back, folks, as we explore this what we're about to happen to us on January the 20th, and questions about the Electoral College, the questions of this divide in America can be bridged, and we're going to talk a bit in this half an hour as well about the cabinet picks and what they say, which is kind of a middle finger to the establishment in some ways, not completely. And we'll talk a bit about that as well. We're here with Dr. Anne McCarthy, Dean of the Business School at Hamline University in Minneapolis, Kevin Gastola, who is a journalist and managing editor of Shadowproof.com, and Quincy Campbell, who is of One Baltimore and is a Democratic operative and worked in unions here in this country for a long time as well. And all of you at 410-319-8888. As I promised, right to the phones, Owusu and Baton Rouge are on the air. Welcome.
Good morning to everyone.
Good morning.
I just wanted to make an observation about how the disenfranchisement of African Americans contributes to the unfairness of the Electoral College. Like, the Constitution counted the enslaved African Americans as three-fifths of the population, three-fifths of a person, so they were counted giving the southern states more electoral power. And even today, prisoners are counted in the census data. So
right.
A lot of times you have folks incarcerated in very rural, predominantly white areas, but they're given even more representation because of the prison population. I'd like for your guests to respond to that. And thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you, too, Owusu. Thanks so much for listening and calling in. Thoughts on that? I mean, that is part of this. And also, you know, you can take it up to this 21st century and this last election, where half of the Detroit ballots, almost all exclusively in the black community, were not counted. People were not able to vote. There were different counts of 30 to 300,000 voters in Wisconsin who were denied the right to vote because of voter ID laws and more. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a historical question.
It's now.
It's happening now.
Yeah. I mean, there's no disagreeing with that. It's embarrassing what people are trying to do to keep people from voting.
Yeah.
And I think that's a real danger we have, because, I mean, we saw the evisceration of the Voting Rights Act, which was a really critical part of what happened in the 60s and was passed by this mm-hmm. country and has been eviscerated by this court.
I'm surprised, though, by the rise, what I would call the rise. Maybe it's always been this way. We just haven't documented it. With the one-issue voter, you know, I've been listening to NPR a lot, and they've been doing those listening tours, and they've gone back to Pennsylvania, you know. And there was a Mexican immigrant in Montana or Wyoming, and she talked about how she voted for Trump in the end because he supported the Second Amendment. And, you know, locally to you, the woman who wrote the op-ed in the Washington Post who voted for Trump because she was Muslim and she liked his stance on, you know, sort of radical Islamic terrorists. And then the woman in York, Pennsylvania who voted for him, she was the one who only sort of took the entire principles. She didn't like the guy at all. She voted for the principles of the Republican Party. And for her, a big issue was abortion. And I think we have a splintering of U.S. society based on whatever issue is the most important to you as opposed to the holistic picture of the candidate. We're not always going to get all of our issues in one candidate. And yet we're voting on one issue for some people.
That is happening with a body. I don't know what the exact percentage of that is. I don't know if you do, Kevin, but that I think that is part of what's happening here in the country.
But we also have so many folks who are voting against the totality of their own self-interest, which I think is pretty frightening. I watched I'm not a big MSNBC fan, but I watched the town hall with Senator Sanders last week.
Oh, yeah,
and
I saw part of that.
He spent an hour debunking everyone who said why they voted for Trump. And he had a very...
With an audience of people who voted for Trump.
Voted for Trump, but literally half of them, he had them shaking their head after, you know, a pretty logical conversation about, you know, voting in your self-interest. So we live in, what the Chinese say, interesting times.
Yeah.
That's why I think that's why I've been one of those, as my wife said from the very beginning of this race, that if Bernie had been the nominee, Democrats might have won.
I can't believe I let you walk into that again. I can't believe I opened up that.
You did.
my fault.
Why would you say if Bernie had been the nominee, he would have won?
Yeah. Kevin, and then we go back to the phones here.
Yeah. No, I mean, I hate to retread ground that's been retread for the last 2 months, but I think we're on to the fact that, you know, the message out there is about, I think they really are about class issues, whether you want to call them that or not. This is about people who want to have fair play and a fair share, and they don't think that that exists in this country, and they're correct. And I think that what we're dealing with when we're talking about one-issue voters is this thing that people don't quite know how to use that vote. And so they're not sure that, you know, either of those people are going to maybe make their lives better economically, or that doesn't cross their mind. And so they say, well, at least I can make sure I keep my gun. Or they say, at least maybe I can make sure that more Mexicans don't come over the border and take my job. Or things that aren't really going to materially help them. And so that's what we have. And I just would say to the caller that did say a really important point there, that I was just thinking of Ava DuVernay's documentary on Netflix, The 13th, and
yes.
I highly recommend that.
Incredible documentary.
And getting to that huge issue of racism and the legacy of slavery.
And I think, I mean, ultimately, that's the one issue. I mean, I guess we probably 15 minutes into this segment. If we're talking about one issue voters and where it was most prevalent, I'm sorry. I think all of this is rooted in the fact that the president for the last 8 years was a black man. And so many folks found a lot of different ways to dress up a vote when really it was just a dramatic course correction. Cornell Belcher has a great book out now about President Obama. And he sort of predicted or reflected on this dramatic course correction that this country would take. And I'm just not persuaded yet, and I'm trying to be very fair, and I'm just not persuaded yet that this was just a repudiation of a black man's party in power. And that's just sort of where I am.
Let me go back to the phones here. 410-319-8888. Jeffrey, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you. Can you hear me?
We can, Jeffrey. Welcome.
Thank you. I listen to your show off and on, as well as Democracy Now! And other shows, but the thing about it is you got to put everything in perspective. It all has to be put in perspective, and we are talking about issues here, issues there, but we all have to find something that you can act upon. The fact that Donald Trump is now probably in debt to Putin and China, and he's been a president of his own kingdom, his own world. He's a kingdom he's already in within itself, and so the fact that he is probably in debt to these guys, and now all the people, you watch all the people that are in his cabinet coming together, the guy from Alabama, and watch the stuff they're doing in North Carolina. And so when all this comes together and you focus on it, this is a serious matter, and the Electoral College should have time to get the information, classified information, so that they can make a decision based on, he hadn't showed his taxes, so he's probably in debt to Putin and whoever else, and all these, you know, you guys got to look at the whole picture. You can't just focus on one thing and then say, go wheel, let's attack this, let's attack. You have to be able to do that. And when with them taking the vote, this is going all over the place, but with them taking our votes and some of the votes not being counted, that has all made a difference. The gerrymandering, all of it, has come to the fact that he's going to be the leader of this country, and it's going to go in a direction that's going to be that we could be like third world people as well. That's like the people in Syria and those other countries.
Jeffrey, I appreciate what you just said. Let's wrestle a bit with what you said here before we go to our next caller. I mean, I think, Anne, you want to pick up on that first?
Well, you know, I've been watching, as everybody has, his cabinet picks, and some of them are quite good, and some of them are not so good, really concerning, and some of them are just confusing, like why. Like Rick Perry, seriously? He couldn't even remember the department. Remember his oops-a moment?
Yes.
Yeah. And on the other hand, Nikki Haley's not bad, and so Elaine Chao, not bad. I mean, they're both competent, good people.
Oh.
I think, you know, the one that they call the warrior monk, you know, who's going to be in charge of defense. He's a thoughtful man. So some of these are good
James
picks.
Mattis, you
James
mean?
Mattis.
Yes.
The general?
Yes.
General.
Yes.
Mad Dog Mattis.
Yes, Mad Dog Mattis.
That's who you want.
So the question is, how much is he going to listen to the reasonable people on his cabinet, and how much is he going to act impulsively like he has been, despite even his own campaign managers trying to keep him reined in?
So before we go to our next caller, let's look at this for a minute. I mean, so you know, you've got this really interesting range of people in his cabinet. And you're right. The people you happen to pick out are for quote-unquote mainstream Republicans, right?
Okay.
And that tilts a little further right than mainstream Republicans used to tilt, but our mainstream Republicans, Nikki Haley and Elaine Chao.
Yeah.
But you've got Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State.
Problem.
Buddy of Putin's, invest with Putin and Russia, head of ExxonMobil, Secretary of State. Ryan Zinke in Interior is a man who wants to dismantle the national parks and allow grazing and mining happening inside of the national park areas. Rick Perry, we've said that already. Andrew Pudzer, the fast food king.
The labor guy.
Head of labor, who has no belief, it doesn't believe that we need this minimum wage.
Doesn't mean that we need a workforce either.
Right. Linda McMahon, head of small business. Yeah. Maybe, we'll see. Scott Pruitt, doesn't believe in climate change, head of the EPA. And John Kelly, who's made some fairly outrageous kind of remarks, I think, who is head of Homeland Security.
So Jeff Sessions. That's a problem.
As there'll be no more consent decrees anywhere in America around issues of police and violence or anything else.
Department of Justice, which ramifications for urban America are.
Yeah, I mean, so it's a real mixed bag. And if you look at the inside of the White House itself, we can't keep forgetting Steve Bannon. You've got Steady Eddie and Renice Priebus. But then you've got Michael Flynn, who's really kind of a, even many people in the military thought he was a little wing nutty as head of national security advisor, and a very conservative person in Donald McGahn as White House counsel. So these Kevin are not. It is a mixed bag.
It is a mixed bag.
No, and I think
that
the
biggest mixed bag is not who they are. In some sense, it is. That's important. I'm not trying to diminish that. But even if he got the best cabinet we ever thought possible, like Jesse Ventura did decades ago here in Minnesota when he surprised everybody. The problem with Trump is you don't know how much he's going to listen to even the people he chose to be his advisors. That's what's sort of disconcerting to me.
Yeah.
Man, who doesn't want to tell? Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, no, I think that we do kind of know how Donald Trump works. If we've paid attention, I believe the conventional wisdom is that he does the last thing that he was told by the last person he talked to. And that's what frames his perspective, and that's sort of been why he's impulsive, because he's had an array of characters that have been influencing him all along this election. But I think the critical thing about these cabinet picks, if I could make a few points about each of these people, not going through each of their personalities, but what you see in common is that, you know, by and large, these are people who are being asked to head institutions that they instinctively despise and don't like what they do in the way that they regulate those parts of industry. Even if you're talking about an inexperienced person who has, zero experience, like Ben Carson, I mean, he's being asked to be involved in public housing when he seems to hate the whole idea of public housing.
Right.
And so it's just, you know, incredible. And so also you have basically the removal of middlemen from our government. That's my view, is that we've had people in these institutions like the EPA you could say in the U.S. Treasury Department, because you had Hank Paulson before. And you can say you've had people there who had ties to corporations. Donald Trump seems to say, I've been elected president, and I don't even want to have that as a thing anymore. I'm just going to cut out the middlemen and let people who are part of the corporations run our government.
Hmm. Let me open the phones here and get our listeners back in the conversation of 410-319-8888. And let's go to Duane. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah. You know, Barack Obama, you know, famously, or I should say infamously, said, you know, we get the democracy we deserve. You know, I often say we get the democracy that we are. You know, Donald Trump becoming the president, you know, is a reflection of who we are as Americans. You know, the Republicans are the greatest marketers in history. Democrats are horrible at it. You know, just horrible at marketing. Horrible.
Thank you.
horrible, you know? And, you know, and so, you know, we need Donald Trump to just screw everything up, to wake everybody up, you know, that elections are important and for people to show up and actually vote. So, you know, we have earned the right to get totally destroyed by Donald Trump and all the bad stuff that comes from it. We earned it. We justly earned it. And maybe we need this smack to wake ourselves up.
Dwayne, thanks for that call. Let's get another caller in here. We'll come back to our panel of 410-319-8888. Appreciate the call and the ideas and thoughts. Andrew, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning, Andrew.
I was listening to the radio. Good morning. I was listening to the radio yesterday, and they were talking about the fact that they're going to investigate the Clinton Foundation, and they also were going back to the whole email thing, and it seems like there's some vindictiveness that's getting ready to spring forth from the Republicans. And the first thought I had was, well, what about when the president won, when Barack Obama won, and you didn't hear any of that kind of stuff, despite the fact that you had a guy like Cheney, who was enhanced by what happened over in Iraq via Halliburton, and Vice President shot a guy in the face, for example, and didn't even have to give a statement afterwards because the guy was obviously drunk. And it seems like nobody cares, you know, about that kind of stuff, and yet now, all of a sudden, here we go with this investigation they're talking about, and I don't know, I just, it seems so crazy to me. What do you guys think about that?
Go ahead, Quincy.
You know, I don't think they're really concerned with relitigating those battles of the past, whether it be investigating Benghazi or, you know, all the things that you heard in the campaign. I think the Republicans, Trump specifically, looking forward to what they can get done in the interest of the Trump business. I think Speaker Ryan and Leader McConnell, I think they're looking forward how they can dismantle Obamacare. I think there'll be some political pettiness because that's just the nature of this business. But they just have such a unique moment now to get so many, in my field, regressive things done. I just think they're just looking forward to seeing what they can screw up, starting with Obamacare.
And I think what Andrew also said, that Barack Obama made a conscious decision not to seek prosecution around the war in Iraq. He was very clear about that. Whether you agreed with that or not, that was a decision that Barack Obama made.
And some right? Presidential deference.
I don't know what they're going to do around the Clinton Foundation. I mean, all the investigations so far, there really is not a there anymore than there's a there about the Trump Foundation, which is, you know, a shell game mostly. But, you know, I hope that we don't
political stuff
get into that stuff in Congress. There's no sense of where that's going to go, though, I think.
The most important thing is for both parties to think towards the future and building the next generation. Part of why, Kevin's point, you know, both parties nominated two people who were the most despised candidates ever in the history of the United States is because we're not looking forward. We're looking backwards. And I personally think it would be nice to see somebody from the next generation, so to speak, be supported and be brought into the spotlight. Like Nikki Haley. I like her.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with the caller more who said, you know, Trump is a reflection of the democracies that we are. I think that brings forward a lot of uncomfortable truths that we're going to have to confront and face, especially as we find our way forward. And just to go back to something that was said earlier in the hour, I think that there's both a negative situation that we find ourselves in and also a positive situation that we find ourselves in, and that in this kind of crisis and panic that people are feeling, there is an actual opportunity to turn this around and do something better with our country. And I think that you're seeing, I'm bringing into this conversation the movements that are going on in the race for the DNC chair. You know, it's being in this past week or last week, you saw Keith Ellison throwing out or doing an official event with the Our Revolution group that spawned off of the Bernie Sanders campaign, bringing in hundreds of thousands of people in the country to increase his support that he has already in the Senate and the House of Representatives. And you're seeing that between him and Bernie, that Sanders, that there's going to be a counter force to Donald Trump, and we're starting to see the formation of something that's going to really challenge Donald Trump, but I think actually smartly challenge Trump in the sense that it's going to be about consistency. It's going to be not only this is what we need to do to not be xenophobic and racist and promote only the best for the corporations, but also, you know, you said things while you were campaigning that aren't so bad for this country. You know, for example, you said that we could renegotiate drug prices in this country and make it easier to import cheaper medicine, and that you weren't going to just sell out to big pharmaceutical companies. And right now, Republicans aren't backing that kind of legislation that would make it better for consumers. And so I think that we're going to have this force that challenges Trump and challenges his drilling. The thing that's really problematic to me with his cabinet picks is this, the number of people who are in favor of opening up so much public land to oil and gas drilling. I think that's going to be very devastating. And the fact that nobody takes climate change seriously is really devastating. I think, especially for younger people like myself, looking forward, you know, are we going to have a planet is a sort of question we're asking ourselves as we look to the election of Donald Trump.
So let me ask you this quick question before I want to ask Anna a question very quickly as well. But let me ask you this question first, Quincy.
Okay.
As a Democratic insider, what about you know, somebody who's been worked inside the Democratic Party in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
So what about this battle now around the Keith Ellison? And now we see Tom Perez being pushed, I think, by some establishment sections because they're worried about Keith's statements on Israel and is it being a Muslim, some of that, and as like that. So where do you see it going?
Well, it's interesting. One, I am great friends with Keith Ellison. I worked with him in 2004 on the Kerry campaign in Minnesota. Great guy. But what you see happening now is really the Sanders camp versus the Obama camp. Obviously, the president spoke glowingly about Secretary Tom Perez, a Marylander, a person who, you know, we all love here. And I think that's what it's going to come down to, sort of, you know, Obama's pick and the influence that he still holds over the Democratic Party membership, the 400 and some odd folks, versus Keith's insurgency propped up by the Bernie camp. The reality of the situation is there aren't many Bernie supporters within that DNC membership. So this notion that Keith is even competitive now.
You don't think he is?
I don't think he is. I don't think he is. I mean, there aren't many. We don't have to replay, you know, what happened with Bernie within the party. But you're really talking about 450 insiders. And while some are disgruntled about how things went, some are very upset with the direction of the Hillary campaign. The president holds a lot of sway over these folks. So if I was betting now, and, you know, I'm coming off losing two elections in a row, but if I
not laughing at you, you just, that was big. Right, right.
You know, my professional. I think Tom Perez is the inside choice leading candidate. And would be a really good chair.
When I was running campaigns, I lost more than I won. Yeah. I can laugh when you say that.
Hey, Babe Ruth missed more balls than he hit.
Talk a minute before I try to get another call in here to end the conversation for this hour. A bit about Nikki.
I want to say something before about you know the oil and gas and the drilling, which does concern me too. But there is something more insidious going on here without our knowledge, which is the purchase of oil refineries in the United States by mostly Aramco, which is a Saudi Arabian oil company. This is a threat to national security because they can just shut down a refinery, and the price of our gas will skyrocket despite what the amount of oil is that's being produced around the world. And I think that the Saudis have figured that out. They have figured out that OPEC is basically broken. They can't get agreement because the poor nations are going to pump more oil to try to get more oil into their government coffers, which is totally rational. So the way the Saudis are going to now begin to control the price of oil is to buy refineries and basically do what Enron did, which was, you know, they would shut down, you know, state electrical substations, and people's rates would just skyrocket. And nobody, and this is happening under the Obama administration, no one is paying attention to this.
That's a really, really interesting point. And the question is, with the connections that so many people in this new administration have with oil and with big oil, will they even begin to take that on?
I know.
Despite the kind of more national sentiments of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Right.
At least the outward national sentiments of Donald Trump. I'm not sure.
Rex Tillerson.
Rex, exactly. And do we have time for one more quick call? Yes, one call. So Ernie, your closing thought, what is it?
Yes, I do. Really quick, just a couple of points. Going back to the repudiation of black president comment, and I think I agree with that, and it's kind of almost like there's been an illusory kind of increase in life quality for blacks in the minds of, I think, many whites in the country just because we had a black president. Without any real focus or look at our unemployment numbers, you know, number of people shot by women and men shot by police. And I think one of the things that we have to wrap our heads around is trying to understand why this happens, is many people are really unaware of really what's at stake for much of white America and what these past 8 years have really meant. And I think I just wanted to recommend one particular book, Possessive Investment in Whiteness by George Lipsitz, really lays out the underbelly of what white folks have at stake that they aren't even conscious of. So I just kind of wanted to put that in. And the last thing is just, I think in terms of how we go forward, I think intersectionality and understanding how to bring together all these various groups and alliances is the only way that you can combat, in quote, this Trumpism. In other words, the strategy that's been used to actually anoint him as our you know, president to be.
Ernie, I'm glad you got in. Appreciate the call. This has been a fascinating panel. I want to thank the three of you for really a really, really thoughtful and the panel in depth here. Kevin Gastola, good to have you on the show with us here. Managing editor for Shadowproof.com. Look forward to having you back many more times.
Thank you.
Great having you with us. Dr. Ann McCarthy, Dean of the Business School at Hamline University in Minneapolis. Regular commentator on the show. Great to have you back with us on such a consistent basis, Ann.
Always a pleasure, Mark.
And Quincy Gamble of One Baltimore, a Democratic operative who ran Hillary's campaign here in Maryland, was his last big event, I think. Is that right?
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you too, brother and sister, and all of you. It was great. So thank you all so much. It was a really good discussion, and all listeners were calling in. When we take a break here, we're going to come back. When we do come back, we are going to be tackling local issues. We're going to be looking at the consent decree, as well as the deficit in the schools and how they may be connected. And will the mayor sign the consent decree? We'll be back.